Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL Schedule Release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule-release to learn more.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Weird House Cinema. This is Rob Lamb.
And this is Joe McCormick. And today on Weird House Cinema, we're going to be talking about the, I usually say the year, but now I'm not so sure. Was it actually released in 1972?
Yes, it was. And I want to stress, Joe, that it was released 1972 of the Common Era.
Okay, not 1972 BCE, right? Correct. This is Dracula AD 1972, the Hammer horror movie starring Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing.
That's right. So last week, we not only did a Frankenstein movie, we did one of the best known and most beloved of all Frankenstein movies, 1935's Bride of Frankenstein. And to follow that up, I have been feeling weeks in advance like we would need to do a Dracula movie after that. But which one, right? There's so many Dracula films to choose from. We've been talking about doing 1931's Dracula or the Mexican Dracula film that came out the same year. Those, I think, are both fine choices. But I found I was craving not just a Drac movie, but a weird spin on Dracula, which brings us back to the world of late franchise ingenuity, which is something I always enjoy. You know, that point in a film franchise where people realize, all right, we've done the same thing over and over again. We need to go in a new direction. We need to spice it up. What can we do?
Dracula Goes West, or Dracula in Space. That's a real movie. Dracula 3000.
Yeah. These are all valid choices. Dracula in the Old West has also been done. I just love it when a franchise gets maybe a little desperate and starts taking some risks. And that's where we are with the seventh film in Hammer Horror's Dracula series. Kicked it off with 58's Dracula, then 1960's The Brides of Dracula, then Dracula, Prince of Darkness in 66, then Dracula Has Risen from the Grave in 68, then Taste the Blood of Dracula in 70. And then we have Scars of Dracula. I think that's the same year. And then we get to Dracula AD 1972, which had the fabulous working title of Dracula Today.
It sounds almost like the name of a publication, like it's a magazine for the modern Dracula connoisseur.
Yeah, or I mentioned it to my wife and she's like, it sounds like a morning show, like Dracula hosts the morning show. It's Dracula Today, and he's got his hot mug of blood. So at this point in the film franchise, we're definitely in that experimental mode. And it would stay that way for the duration. The film to follow this up was 73's The Satanic Rites of Dracula, which I have not seen, but I've definitely flagged it because it's my understanding that it's sort of a Dracula spy movie.
Yes, I have seen this one. I've mentioned this on the show before, but this was an especially hilarious movie viewing experience because I watched it with early YouTube auto-generated subtitles with a group of friends, and the subtitles were all wrong.
There was one point where somebody, I don't remember what the actual line in the movie was, but the subtitle took it for the boat carrying General Freeballs.
General Freeballs. Okay. I don't think he's established in this film, though some of the characters from this film will carry on into the next one.
There's also a line that the subtitles interpreted as Peter Cushing or a Peter Cushing type guy answering a telephone and saying, saw it on Twitter and I was shocked.
All right. So we've definitely flagged that one for later. The final Dracula movie from Hammer Pictures was actually a co-production with Shaw Brothers. It is 1974's The Legend of the Seven Golden Vampires, an East meets West vampires film. This one's been on the list for a long time. I haven't seen it yet. But, I mean, how can you resist such a mashup?
How could it go wrong? I've got to see that one.
So, yeah, today's movie, Dracula AD 1972, takes the Dracula franchise into modern times. In a way, it's kind of a predecessor to 1979's Time After Time, which we previously talked about on the show.
Oh, yeah, I can see that. I mean, so in that episode, we came up with a taxonomy of different kinds of time travel movies. This isn't exactly a time travel movie because nobody actually travels. There is no time machine. Nobody leaves the time they're naturally in. But it is a generation spanning movie where the vampire is slain in one era and resurrected in another. So you might expect there to be some, I don't know, kind of a fish out of time elements like we talked about in that episode, where the character from the past is forced to deal with how things have changed in the modern world. I must say, none of that. There's nothing like that at all.
Yeah, I've seen some reviewers who, more recent reviewers who've commented on that, like saying, why is there not a fish out of water, fish out of time plot element to this? And part of my thinking on that, I'm thinking, okay, well, you don't want to make Dracula look foolish. This film takes Dracula's status seriously.
Yes.
And Dracula remains like a severe threat. He is just hunger and evil. But on the other hand, as we've seen in other films, it can be done. You can do the fish out of time at least a little bit and have the character that is engaging in it still be fearsome. The example that comes to mind, just off the top of my head, would be the Terminator. It's not much of a fish out of time, but there is that one funny moment where he tries to go in and buy a plasma rifle from Dick Miller.
Yes. Yeah. Just what you see, pal.
Yeah, it is a funny moment, but it doesn't make the Terminator less terrifying in that film. So there's some sort of balance that would have been possible with Dracula going out at night and feeding on hippies. But Dracula just doesn't get out in this movie and do that sort of thing.
That's exactly the issue. So the movie is trying to be it's trying to be conceptually fish out of time. It's trying to say, okay, we have this monster from a different era. You know, he came to London and in this movie in the 1870s, and suddenly he's here in the 1970s, and whoa, it's a crazy context. There are all these hippies and cars everywhere. This is not what we expect to see surrounding Dracula. But Dracula is never, like, he never meets any of that stuff. In his resurrected form, he just hangs out in a church. So I don't think he ever even sees any of the signs of the modern world.
Right. He's just ordering, like, takeout delivery. Essentially, yeah. The whole time. He doesn't get out and see that world. You know, whether he'd be fazed by the changes in the world, who can say? I mean, maybe Dracula just sees blood at the end of the day, and so it doesn't matter. He's like, it doesn't matter at all. Just bring me the blood. But maybe you could have had some neat moments.
The Dracula in this movie does not seem very impressed or even very reactive to anything around him. He, you know, there's the part where his lackey raises him from the dead and says, "Master, I've brought you back." And he just says, "It was my will." Mm-hmm. Walks past him. So I don't know. I kind of think that that aloofness and high-handedness might come through as well if he were forced to, you know, be around automobiles or something. It'd be like he wouldn't even notice them. He'd just walk past them.
Yeah, it would have been interesting to see how they would have handled it. Now, one thing I want to mention about this particular movie is, yeah, with its elements of, like, hippies and groovy London counterculture, to the limited extent that it is explored, as I was digging on this one, I was like, oh, man, I wonder if this one is Electric Wizard certified, because the themes just seem to fit too perfectly for this to not be the case. And so I looked it up. I grabbed the book, Come My Fanatics, A Journey into the World of Electric Wizard by Dan Franklin, which came out earlier this year. And it basically is just filled with various movies, references and movie mentions that line up with their work. And it is, in fact, cited as an influence. Dracula AD 1972 is cited as an influence on the excellent 2007 album, Witch Cult Today.
I know the wizard, and I can see this movie being right up their alley. They love some witch finders and some Hammer horror and all that good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Satanic Rites of Dracula, obvious. Obviously, there's a connection there. The title track on the album, Witch Cult Today, reminds one of Dracula Today. And then they also have that Torquemada 71 track, which also has sort of like similarities to the title here. So, yeah, I can see this one as having been a strong influence now that it's been pointed out to me.
Now, here's a question. This is a convention. I can think of several examples of movies like this, where it's Dracula and then just the number of a year. So there's Dracula 1972, Dracula 2000, and Dracula 3000, which is the one in space with Casper Van Dien.
Is that one in the year 3000?
I guess it's supposed to be. That one's okay. Really, really not good, like Z grade. Though it does make one choice that I really like, which is it sets it in the future. So they're on like a spaceship. I think Casper Van Dien's character is Captain Von Helsing of the USS, whatever it is. Maybe the Demeter. I don't know. But they come across Dracula in a derelict spaceship. But then when they wake him up, is he like a spacey Dracula? Is he wearing kind of a spooky space suit? No, he's just dressed in like a Halloween store Dracula costume with like the cape and the high collar and the ruffles.
You know, I doubt they pulled it off and made it work. But on paper, I respect the choice. I do like it when Dracula is like powerful in spite of the tropiness of the way he is dressed. Mm-hmm. And I think that an example of that can be found in this movie, because Christopher Lee, again, his Dracula maybe doesn't have as much to do, doesn't get to do as much killing and exploring as we would like, but it is still a strong screen presence. It is still like a terrifying vision of Dracula.
Yeah, I think Christopher Lee is almost always pretty strong. I think he's good in the moments he has, though I do think the movie underuses him. We kind of don't get enough Christopher Lee, and we don't get enough of several of the movie's big selling points.
That's true. Oh, but to come back to what you were saying, yeah, Dracula 72. But it was also released as Dracula 73 in France and Spain as it came out in 73. So they had to upgrade the title. Nobody wants last year's Dracula. I mean, come on. But it's worth looking up the French poster for Dracula 73 because it's absolutely stunning. It's like, I don't even know how to explain it. It's got this weird kind of, I don't know, almost kind of like Art Deco looking font. And then Dracula's head is like this psychedelic floating visage in the sky, gazing hungrily at bikini women.
It really doesn't look like Christopher Lee. It's more like a floating monster mask that is bleeding colors into the stratosphere.
Yes. So look that up. It's good. Now, I want to stress that this movie is not everyone's favorite. Roger Ebert only gave it one star, single star. Michael Weldon of Psychotronic Film Guide called this one's time jump, quote, a big mistake. And I even touched base with Hammer fan and former producer of the show, Seth Nichols Johnson, who, you know, again, big fan of a lot of Hammer films. He says this is not one of his favorites. He likes it, but it's not one of his favorites.
Fair enough. I think it'll make for a good discussion on the show, but I'll say it's not one of the best Hammer horror Draculas. I think Horror of Dracula is much better.
No. I think to enjoy this film, you've got to be on board for, again, late franchise innovation, for some sort of, risky, if not completely realized dream of where Dracula could take you. And I guess also the further away we are from it in time, the more it has been allowed to age. Because I know a lot of these commentators were talking about when it first came out. Weldon criticized it as being already dated when it hit the screen. But we've had decades for this film to mature, and now we can appreciate it for what it is.
I suspect people might have found the hippie caricatures more grating in the 70s. I find them delightfully amusing now.
Yeah, I think that could be part of it. All right. Elevator pitch for this one. I would say these hippies are such a drain on society. Of course, they resurrected Dracula.
It's the dope. It's the devil music. It's the Dracula rites.
That's right. My other one that I came up with is parents. Be aware of these warning signs that your 25-year-old teenager may be involved with drugs, sex, black masses, rock music, and Dracula resurrection.
We do have several parenting scenes where Peter Cushing is trying to exert a positive influence on his granddaughter, Jessica. You know, he's trying to figure out, like, hey, are her friends on the level? But it just doesn't go anywhere.
No. All right, let's listen to some trailer audio.
Yesterday, Dracula was the most fearsome being the screen has ever seen. Today, tonight, you could be Dracula's next victim.
Something new, yet as old as time.
Come on, Johnny.
A date with the devil.
Are you ready? He's ready. He's waiting to freak you out. Right out of this world.
Died September the 18th, 1872. 100 years ago to the day.
You who witness it must swear before the name of the devil to keep it secret.
But who knows about vampires, for God's sake?
My grandfather died fighting a vampire. The most terrible, the most dangerous vampire of all time.
No. The year is 1972. A leap year in horror. A vintage year for vampires. For the masters of horror to meet again in the 20th century.
Come to me, come Dracula!
All right, well, if at this point you would like to go watch Dracula AD 1972 for yourself, well, you're in luck because this one was released through Warner Brothers, so it's widely available. It's even currently available in the States, at least on Max. It looks like they have a number of Hammer horror flicks in there. So, yeah, go crazy. You can also get it on basically any physical or digital format you desire. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astepro allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. All right, let's do those connections.
All right, the director is Alan Gibson, who lived 1938 through 1987. Canadian director who worked a lot in the UK with TV work going back to the mid-60s, but it's his horror work that most remember him for today. His credits include 1970s Goodbye Gemini, which I believe is some sort of scary twin movie. This film, of course, and its follow-up, 1973's The Satanic Rites of Dracula. He also continued to work in TV and directed episodes of the anthology series Thriller, Tales of the Unexpected, and Hammer House of Horror. In fact, one of the Hammer House of Horror episodes he directed was The Silent Scream, starring Peter Cushing, but also a young Brian Cox, who was actually, I think we did the math, he would have been like 34 at the time.
Wow. It's hard to understand that I'm looking at Brian Cox younger than I am now.
Yeah. He came out with, I mean, Brian Cox has always made a career of, playing at least, heavies and
Formidable personalities.
Yeah. Not so much, leading man type stuff. So, he's one of those actors who perhaps even early on always looked like he was in his late 40s at least. Mm-hmm. But great actor. I haven't seen the episode, but I might have to seek it out.
And you said it's also got Peter Cushing?
Yeah. Peter Cushing, is just, he was on speed dial for Hammer. They needed him for something. He's like, yeah, is it a movie? Fine. I'm there. TV show? Great. I need to fly to China? Great. Let's make it work.
It's nice to have steady work.
Yes. All right. The screenwriter for this one is Don Houghton, who lived 1930 through 1991. British television screenwriter and producer whose writing credits include 13 episodes of Doctor Who from 1970, The Satanic Rites of Dracula, The Seven Golden Vampires movie, and also another Shaw Brothers Hammer co-production from 1974, an action picture titled Shatter. I believe Peter Cushing is in that one as well.
Okay. Is it about a man who has the power to shatter?
It looked like it's kind of like crime, action, maybe spy. I'm not sure. It's one of those non-horror Hammer films that perhaps gets re-explored less in the modern era.
I see.
All right. Well, who's playing the title character of Count Dracula? Well, of course, it's Christopher Lee, who lived 1922 through 2015. We've talked about Lee before on the show as he's popped up in numerous films we've discussed already and is just going to keep popping up because he's an icon of horror. But here he is in one of his most iconic roles, the one that influenced his casting and presentation in late career hits like the Star Wars prequels, like Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings films. He was, I think, rather famously tired of playing Dracula at this point in his career, or at least tired of playing Dracula the Hammer way. I'm to understand the 1970 Jess Franco picture Count Dracula was more in line with what he wanted to do with the character at that point in his career. But still, Again, it's a great screen presence, and one can only imagine that he enjoyed working once more with his friend and longtime co-star of 22 films, Peter Cushing.
Do you know what his take in the Franco Count Dracula is? How's it different?
I haven't seen it in its entirety yet. It was actually a film I was considering for this month on Weird House, because it's supposed to be, first of all, not as sleazy as other Jess Franco films. Like, it's a little more mainstream, has a great cast. You have like Klaus Kinski playing Renfield in it, but it's supposed to be more of like a sympathetic, tragic Dracula. Mm-hmm. And I'm to understand it's the first Dracula film in which we initially meet an elderly Dracula who is then made young again through the consumption of blood.
Oh, okay. So this has many things in common with what would later happen in Bram Stoker's Dracula, directed by Coppola, which we were just talking about in our core episodes earlier this week.
Yeah, yeah.
That has the at least partially sympathetic Dracula, adds in a love story for Dracula, which I want to emphasize is not in the book. Dracula is not in love. He does not romance in the book. He is just a demon. He's just bad. And that also has a Dracula who, when Jonathan Harker first meets him in Transylvania, he looks very old and decrepit. But by the time he reaches London, he is young and rejuvenated and old many.
So, yeah, the Dracula that we get in Dracula AD 72 is certainly the demonic Dracula. In fact, they call him the demon vampire in the prologue to the picture. He is just pure supernatural hunger. He has more in common with the Terminator than some of the more sympathetic film versions of Dracula that we've seen in this film's wake.
Yeah, just a mean, nasty, vengeful, uncomplicated demonic vampire. Now, I mentioned this earlier, but just to get a little bit deeper into it, I feel like Christopher Lee is good in this movie, but one of my major complaints about the film is that it is reserved in the deployment of its key selling points, one of them being Christopher Lee. He's an ineffectual vampire. He doesn't have a lot of lines and he has limited screen time, and that screen time is confined to basically just two locations. It feels almost like they were trying to make sure they could shoot all of his scenes on the same day. And you could see how the fact that he never leaves the church he's resurrected in the modern era, I don't think there's ever a scene of him going anywhere else. Is there? I can't think of one.
I don't think so.
Yeah, so he's just there. So you could say, well, that speaks to his power, right? So, you know, he just stays there and he has his servants bring him victims. So, like, he's so powerful, he doesn't even have to go out hunting. But I don't know. I feel like this movie would deliver more on its promise of Dracula 1972 AD if it had both more of Dracula on screen and going out and doing things in the world, and had more of the world of 1972 AD, which it's also actually relatively tame on, save for like one silly party scene. I think what they should have done is have Dracula go to the coffee bar while it's like hopping and everybody's partying, and he goes and, I don't know, I guess he wouldn't dance, but he would at least like get encounter hippie culture there.
Yeah, like kill Mick Jagger in the street or something, right?
Yeah.
I think just one sequence of him feasting on hippie blood elsewhere in London would have gone a long way. And if you were determined to have him not leave the churchyard, maybe just like one scene where he like looks out the window at night and like sees what's out there. You could even play it up like, oh man, if Dracula gets loose in 1972 London, it's all over. Like, that's why he has to be stopped here before he has reached full feasting power again. But they don't really explore any of those ideas.
I mean, it's easy to forget because the book itself is very old now, but I think one of the themes in the novel Dracula is the idea of some part of the old world coming into the new world. It's that, like, you know, that this, you know, figure from a decaying castle in the Carpathian Mountains out in the forest at the edge of Europe, as these people would have thought of it, coming to the biggest metropolis that they knew of, coming to modern London.
Yeah, that's a great point. So it's already built into the text quite a bit there, that he's traveling across time and space to something new. And yeah, and to come back to time after time, one of the great serious threads in that is that when Jack the Ripper arrives in the modern era, he's like, this place is great. Like, I can really thrive here. Like, and, yes. And you know, and of course that would come later, that film, but a similar vibe, I think, would have gone a long way here. All right, so that's Dracula. but you can't have a Hammer Dracula without a Hammer Van Helsing. And that's where Peter Cushing comes in, playing, this is technically going to be a dual role, because he starts off playing Lawrence Van Helsing, but then will go on to play his descendant, Loramir Van Helsing.
I got some notes on these names. I'll come back to that.
So Peter Cushing lived 1913 through 1994. Again, we've discussed Peter Cushing on the show before, and he's just going to continue to pop up because he was like Christopher Lee, just an iconic player in horror and sci-fi cinema of the day. And I think he was even more prolific. He's one of those actors that everyone seems to have had nice things to say about, both personally and professionally. Just a consummate pro, no matter what the material had him doing or saying. He always brings an air of dignity to most pictures. Mm-hmm. This movie is from the later stage of his career, after the death of his wife in 1971. In fact, filmed just 8 months after her passing. This is an event that apparently took a huge toll on him. In fact, he was apparently originally intended to play the father of the character Jessica Van Helsing in this movie, but he had visibly aged so much since his wife's passing that they rewrote the script a little bit to make him be her grandfather.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I think we might be forgiven for viewing films from this era of his career and detecting that loss and that distance in his screen presence, especially in the various examples of films that cast him as a man who's experienced a great loss. But, you know, that being said, again, consummate professional. He does a solid job in this. And I'm to understand he actually does his own stunts in the opening, which concerns like a thunderous carriage-based action sequence. So it's, you know, it's not just like, oh, he fell out of a chair. No, like he's on a moving carriage. It looks kind of dangerous. And apparently he does whatever stunts are required of him there.
Wow, I'm impressed. Well, I was going to say that, you know, I love Peter Cushing, but I'll admit sometimes he phones it in. You know, give him a break. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of movies and a lot of very similar movies. But strangely, I thought it seemed to me he was putting a lot of feeling into this one. This is not one of his best written roles, but he really exceeds what is required of him. And there was more emotion in this performance than I expected.
Yeah. I mean, it's not just about the man who must defeat the monster, but there's like someone in his life he's trying to protect as well. And not only protect from supernatural threats, but also just sort of ambiguous social threats as well that he's concerned about.
Yeah. His protective care for his grandchild comes through as genuine emotion. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, playing that grandchild, Jessica Van Helsing, is Stephanie Beecham, born 1947. This is our young, prematurely white-haired descendant of the original Van Helsing. Stephanie Beecham is an English actor of stage, screen, and television with a very long and still very active career. She'd mostly done TV and stage at this point in her career, but had popped up in some films, including Roddy McDowall's Tam Lin from 1970 and The Night Comers from 71. After Dracula AD 1972, she acted in 73's And Now the Screaming Starts, 76's House of Mortal Sin and Schizo, and 1981's Horror Planet. Her TV credits include 49 episodes of The Colbys, 23 episodes of Dynasty, in which she plays Sable Colby. I'm not sure how this works, but I'm guessing this is the same character. There's some sort of like, I don't know if this was a spinoff of Dynasty or if like a character from the Colbys joined the cast of Dynasty. I'm not sure how soap operas really work.
I don't know either.
But anyway, it was apparently a big role for her. It's like the top thing that's mentioned on her IMDb page. But she was on other stuff. She's like on The Love Boat. She apparently played Margaret Thatcher on an episode of ALF.
Life goals.
So there's that. I could not find a screenshot of it. I was really looking for it. Could not find it. But she's also been on things like Star Trek The Next Generation, Sequest, in Coronation Street.
I think she's quite good in this, though. She has the same issue that almost all of the teenagers have, which is that none of them seem like teenagers. I think I don't know how old they're supposed to be. I would guess they're supposed to be like, I don't know, 18 to 20, but they all come off as about 30 or at least late 20s.
Yeah, I think she was like 25 at the time.
Not really a problem. I just think it's funny when movies have these groups of all extremely adult teenagers.
All right. The next actor of note is Christopher Neame playing Johnny Alucard. This is the droogish occult enthusiast in the group of friends that we meet, the young Londoners. He cares about only one thing, and it is, of course, the resurrection of Dracula. He is a Dracula cultist.
It's interesting that I think there are a lot of stories that where people become the servants of a satanic entity or demonic overlord so that they can pursue a party lifestyle and hedonistic pleasures. Like the powers they acquire by serving the demon lord give them the ability to party the way they want to. He's the other way around. Johnny Alucard parties in order to serve a demon lord. Like he apparently only does the like swinging hippie thing in order to attract a group of friends who can be brought as snacks to the vampire that he wants to resurrect.
That's right. Johnny Alucard just wants to do Dracula stuff. That's all he wants in life. And he's going to do whatever it takes to get there. So Johnny Alucard is played by Christopher Neame, born 1947. He has a great look. He brings some great hungry energy to this role as a Dracula cultist and vampire wannabe. He kicked off his film career in the 1970 environmental disaster film No Blade of Grass, followed by 71's Lust for a Vampire. This was a these are small roles, I'm to understand. But this role in Dracula AD 1972 seems to have been a big step up for him. He goes on from here to work steadily in all manner of pictures and TV shows, including 30 episodes of Days of Our Lives, 1987 Steel Dawn, a really weird-sounding 1988 sci-fi horror film titled Transformations. He did episodes of Dynasty, episodes of Dallas. He pops up in the 1989 James Bond film License to Kill, in which he plays the agent that is sent to collect the rogue agent James Bond.
Okay. This is the one where Bond he like quits MI6 and he goes on a mission of vengeance.
Yeah, this is the one what's his name explodes.
Robert Davi feeds his friend Felix to a shark and leaves a note saying he disagreed with something that ate him, and so James Bond goes to kill Robert Davi.
Yeah, and Anthony Zerba explodes, right? I think that's how it goes.
Maybe, yeah.
Anyway, Christopher Neame was in a bunch of stuff. He pops up in Ghostbusters 2 playing a maitre d'. He's in the Hulk Hogan film Suburban Commando from 91. He's in the 1994 Chuck Norris film Hellbound. He's in Species 3 from 2004 and then goes on to be in The Prestige from 2006. And just a bunch more all the way up through 2019.
He's perfect in this. He's got a creepy, malevolent, froggy smile. He just he looks like he's up to no good.
Yeah, dangerous youngster. They're very droogish.
He also just gives strong, like, cult leader. It's like you see him and it's like, get this guy a cult stat.
Yeah. All right. We also have the law present in this film, investigating matters that turn out to be Dracula related. We have Inspector Murray, played by Michael Coles, who lived 1934 through 2005. This is our chief law officer investigating a string of strange murders in London. He's presented as a more progressive and sympathetic policeman, but at the same time, he's totally down to invoke draconian drug laws in order to weed out dangerous hippies.
Yeah, I'm going to say no offense to Michael Coles. He does fine. But this oddly shaggy and in some ways sympathetic detective character feels like it was meant for David Warner.
Oh, well, yeah, David Warner would have been good. I mean, David, you could cast David Warner in anything in this film and he would have nailed it. As for Michael Coles, he would reprise this role in 73's The Satanic Rites of Dracula. So I guess the investigation continues. His other credits include 1965's Doctor Who and the Daleks. All right, we basically, as far as the cast goes, there are just a couple other people of note. These are other members of the youth group. Well, it's not a youth group. That makes it sound like it's church-affiliated. These are some more of the swinging Londoners, the young people, the first of which is the character Gaynor, played by Marcia A. Hunt, born 1946. She's an American model, singer, actor, and later author and editor. She only acted in 11 films, but they include such titles as 1982's The Cinder. It's like a psychic sort of scanner-esque flick. 1983's Never Say Never Again, a Bond film. Howling 2, Your Sister is a Werewolf, which is obviously part of the ups and downs of the Howling franchise. Her
They're
bibliography...
all ups.
Her bibliography includes an autobiography, a memoir, and the 1990 novel Joy. Her discography includes three albums from the 1970s, and she was also famously in a relationship with Mick Jagger, and the two had a daughter together.
Oh. She's one of the more friendly presences in the group of London hippies, though she tragically is eaten by Dracula, like several right. characters are.
Another doomed character that fits the same description for the most part is Carolyn Monroe's Laura Bellows. We've talked about Monroe on the show before because, she was a pinup model and actress who stole many a 70s film nerd's heart with such genre appearances as The Spy Who Loved Me, 77, Maniac in 1980, Slaughter High in 86, The Golden Voyage of Sinbad earlier in 73, Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter, another Hammer picture from 74, At the Earth's Core in 76, and also Star Crash in 78. She also has a just slight cameo as a picture of Dr. Fibes' wife in 1971's The Abominable Dr. Fibes.
She is the main character in Star Crash, isn't she? She's still a star?
I think so. Oh, yeah. She's right there. She's on the poster.
Yeah, she is also eaten by Dracula in this movie, and her character is just gaga for demons. Ever yes. since there's the moment the Johnny Alucard brings up, "Hey, what if we did a black mass?" She's like, yes, do it now. Let's go.
It's true. Yeah, she's kind of presented as the, well, of course she was killed by Dracula because she was a bad hippie. So, early victim here.
But I don't understand, why is she so into demons? There are several characters in this movie who have a history of, investigating the occult. So, it's an established interest of theirs. Mm-hmm. It seems like she's never thought of it until Johnny Alucard brings it up. But the moment he's like, let's summon the Prince of Darkness, she can't think of anything else. It's like, this is all I want now.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's, I guess we're already thinking about it more deeply than anyone involved in the film, I think. But, maybe she's supposed to be just sort of like this shallow enthusiast of the occult that doesn't realize that there are, in the world of this film, real threats involved in trying to summon up the spirit of a slain Dracula creature from the past, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. All right, we're going to skip over the rest of the youth in this film and just get right to the music. The music is by Michael Vickers, born 1940. He was a member of the 1960s band Manfred Mann, who I'm not familiar with, but the score and soundtrack for this film is widely available, and I have to say, it's a lot of fun. Most of the score tracks are very jazzy, lots of blaring, horn or saxophone or whatever, as Dracula and Van Helsing chase each other around. But he also gives us a wonderful black mass track titled Devil's Circle Music that is... you see it being played on screen. It is the soundtrack to the black mass that is conducted in the picture. And it itself is a beautiful, creepy cacophony of satanic sounds. So part of me wishes the whole score for this movie sounded like that. But on the other hand, I really like the cheesy content of this film. So I'm glad that we have the blaring jazz present as well.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
All right, with all that behind us, Joe, take us to 1972.
All right. We don't start in 1972.
That's right. We start in 1872, right?
That's right. I'll take you to 1872. How about that? How about we start there? Okay. We begin with dead leaves blowing in the autumn wind. And I noticed in this opening sequence, in some shots, Rob, I don't know if you saw this too. In some shots, the trees are just packed with dense green foliage. And in other shots, they have orange and yellow leaves and fewer of them. And then in a third kind of shot, they're completely bare. I wonder why that is. Could it be that different shots in this, like, I don't know, minute-long carriage chase were shot at different months of the year? That seems unlikely, but I don't know. Maybe it's just different kind of trees or something. Hmm. I was on guard for this because I saw, like, on the very first shot, orange leaves are blowing on the ground, but the trees in the background are fully green, and it reminded me of John Carpenter's Halloween, which you may have never noticed this before, but it's like that. I think it was actually shot in the summer, even though it's supposed to take place in October in Illinois. Mm. So I think they had to, like, bring in bags of dead leaves to dress the, you know, the sets.
Reminds me of the neighborhood that, well, we both live in. Occasionally there are film productions, and there was that one, I think this was like in the summer, where they were filming something for Halloween, and they decorated the whole street for Halloween, like movie level Halloween, decorations. And it was pretty fun. Like, sometimes film productions can, you know, they can get in your way, and then you can be a little grumpy about them disrupting your morning commute or whatever. But that film shoot, God bless it.
Oh, good Lord. Yes. Yeah. Halloween in July. Thank you. I'll take it. So, yeah, we get the leaves blowing. We see red calligraphy letters on the screen that says a Hammer production. And it's that calligraphy font that makes the word Bathory look like Bat Lord. Okay. A horse-drawn carriage is racing along on a parkside pathway, goes over a stone bridge under an archway of these dead tree limbs. And a narrator comes in. Narrator says, "The year is 1872, and the nightmare legend of Count Dracula extends its terror far beyond the mountains of Carpathia to the Victorian metropolis of London. Here in Hyde Park, the final confrontation between Lawrence Van Helsing and his archenemy, the demon vampire Dracula." Now, I told you I was going to come back to the name of Van Helsing in this movie. You did hear that right. It is Lawrence Van Helsing. For some reason, I'm not sure what, this movie and maybe at least one of the other Hammer Horror Draculas calls this character Lawrence. Of course, in the novel, Van Helsing's first name is Abraham. No offense to all of the wonderful Lawrences out there for what I'm about to say, but this name change is not great. A Van Helsing, whose friends call him Larry, does not bring the same gravitas as Abraham.
Yeah.
So why the change? I don't know. Could it possibly have to do with intellectual property? That seems, I don't know, kind of unlikely.
I mean, that would be the main reason to change up the name of a particular character. And of course, historically, we would have seen movements like that before concerning the Dracula property.
Yeah. But I mean, but it's called Dracula, so it would have to be something specific to that one character. Like they could use the last name and the rest of the plot and Dracula, but not Abraham. I don't know. It's confusing. So anyway, the movie opens with the ending of this other tale. We see Dracula and Van Helsing already in the middle of fighting to the death on the roof of this carriage as it races through Hyde Park. They're sort of wrestling. Dracula is choking Van Helsing until suddenly the harness that's holding the horses to the carriage snaps. The horses run off. The carriage veers off the path and crashes into a tree. Van Helsing is thrown aside into the grass, and Dracula, when we see him stagger out from behind the carriage, is impaled on the spoke of a carriage wheel, an accidental stake through the heart. Dracula and Van Helsing fight a little bit more while Drac has a wheel stuck to him, so it's just kind of poking out of him. But eventually Dracula is defeated. Van Helsing kind of shoves the stake into the heart further, and then he does the classic undead turbo rot. So Dracula collapses into a pile of bones, and then that turns into ash and dust by the riverside. Van Helsing also collapses dead.
So at this point, the entire multi-film struggle between Professor Van Helsing and Count Dracula ends in a vehicular accident, which I think would feel mighty underwhelming if this were like the end. But this isn't the end. This is the beginning. So I guess we'll allow it. A freak accident takes both the demon vampire and his chief adversary, takes them both out of action.
But wait a second. Who's this creep back here watching everything go on? There is a young man observing the scene. He'd been following the carriage on horseback. He comes galloping in wearing a top hat. And he's a little guy with a scuzzy mutton chop sideburn set and a toad-like grin. And he produces a glass vial and scoops up some of Dracula's ashes after he turbo rots. Van Helsing's just laying there dying. He ignores Van Helsing. He also pockets Dracula's special ring. It looks like it's made of silver, but I don't think that would make sense for Dracula. So it's some kind of pale precious metal ring.
Yeah, maybe pewter or something. Maybe he can wear pewter. I'm not sure.
Dracula's lead ring.
That would fit, right?
Yeah.
He doesn't have to worry about lead.
So we cut to a funeral scene after that, and it's all of Van Helsing's friends and family gathered in a churchyard where the good doctor's body is being committed to the earth. And it seems most of the mourners are variations on the Monopoly Man. Shiny top hats, coats with tails, all that. It's mostly dudes at the funeral.
And we're not introduced to any of them. We don't know who from the novel Dracula actually showed up at the man's funeral. Like, yeah. I feel like it would be a little bit insulting if Jonathan Harker didn't show up at Van Helsing's funeral, right?
I mean, did they really know each other all that well? They just kind of got together for a work project one time.
Well, yeah, they were their work friends, right?
So. Yeah. Okay. Another funny thing is the line we hear the priest say at Van Helsing's funeral. He's quoting the Bible. So we like come in and he's saying, "Man that is born of woman hath but a short time to live and is full of misery." And I know that's the Bible, but man, is that really what people want to hear at a loved one's funeral? It's like, not only do we die soon, it's mostly bad until we get there.
Yeah. Yeah. Not, I don't want that read at my funeral.
Oh, but a quick side note related to recent Core episodes. You know, the next line after that in the book of Job, this is from Job chapter 14, after the, you know, it's a short time to live full of misery. The next line is, "He cometh forth like a flower and is cut down. He fleeth also as a shadow and continueth not." Anyway, so that funeral's going on. Meanwhile, the creepy guy who collected Dracula's ring and ashes, he shows up at the funeral. He digs a hole in the ground just outside the churchyard, pours Dracula's ashes into the hole, and then drives a stake, the same stake that killed Dracula, into the soil above the hole. And then a marvelous transition. We get jet wipe. We like look up to the sky. And there's a jet plane wipe, and the funky music comes on, wicka wicka wow, and the jet comes down, and we see the title Dracula 1972 AD. Very good use of a jet plane.
Absolutely, it's like bam, now it's modern times. Look at the jet plane. The music has shifted from old timey gothic horror movie to this thoroughly modern, jazzy, funky number. And yeah, my only note here is that we're denied footage of Dracula flying first class. I mean, he's not actually supposed to be in that airplane, but, you know, again, it's like you want, the movie seems to promise this idea of Dracula is in our world now, and it never quite gives us that.
I think they should have done a Pong wipe. So it's wiped to a screen of people playing the Atari. But it's not Pong. It's an airplane. And then what are they going to use to show? We got to get like a 1972 montage, right? Show us some footage of what it means for things to be modern. What does that mean in this film's conception? It's primarily traffic. So we're just seeing like complex highway exchanges teeming with cars set to saxophone and wailing guitar solos.
Yeah, yeah. I guess that's all they really want to convey about the modern world, that it's busy. And you know, the world's fast, it's in a hurry. But meanwhile, Dracula is patient. Dracula is long-lived and is crossing oceans of time to reach the year 1972.
And then from here, we cut straight to a party scene. Now, this is the scene where I think the movie was trying to pack in all of its modern debauchery into like one 5 to 7 minute sequence.
That's right. But their hippies are not like all, is it not like we're dealing with a bunch of sort of grindhousey, like evil hippies or anything. These are all, like, for the most part, likable, fun, goofy kids. Again, I think most of them are at least in their mid-20s, but still, goofy kids having a good time, enjoying the musical stylings of Stone Ground.
Stone Ground. That's the name of the band. They are playing, let's see, so the scene is like hippies versus more Monopoly Men, but Monopoly Men from 1972 instead of 1872. This party is taking place at an elegantly decorated apartment or flat belonging to rich people, full of breakable antiques. There is a buffet table set up with champagne and ice buckets and a bunch of food, but I paused it. Almost all the food appears to be fruit. I guess they thought we wouldn't look too close, or maybe they just really like fruit. Also, several hippies are making out underneath the buffet table. The band Stone Ground is playing in the living room. There are go-go dancers on top of the piano and on the sofa table. Hippies are dancing, presumably doing drugs, though I don't think we see any drugs being done, and getting up to sexual behavior. And all of the rich, posh people are scandalized.
I can't stress enough that Stone Ground as a band looks like what might happen if you took the Muppet Show band and portrayed them as human beings.
Yes.
There's like a human Muppet Show band.
Yeah, yeah. Or like Fraggles, like the Fraggle Band.
Yeah. Michael Weldon wrote in his review, quote, "A party sequence with the American band Stone Ground is a real low point."
Come on.
I would disagree. But then again, I think he was writing this a little closer to the original release time. I would say that it's a goofy good time that also advances the plot somewhat, introduces us to a key character, which we'll get to in just a second. I think you can say, well, perhaps there are some 70s bands that would have been better suited to this film than Stone Ground. I wouldn't say I love the music, but they do appear to have been a real band and all. Like they don't just exist in this film. Sal Valentino was the singer, noted for his earlier work in the 60s group, the Bo Brummels. They did the song Just a Little, and I think they had another hit. And various members of Stone Ground went on to other things.
One of the songs they play at this party is just very generic lyrical content. It's like, "Oh yeah, come on," or something. But the other song is called Alligator Man, and all of the lyrics are about how, like, I'm just a bayou man, you know, you can find me in the bayou because that's all I do. I swim in the water. I'm an alligator man. I think he says, I come from an alligator clan. And I was just looking at the scene. I was like, these are not alligator men. If anything, these are lamprey men.
Yeah. I mean, that's... It's kind of a Creedence vibe, right? Where it's like perhaps not authentic swamp music.
Oh, I don't know. I go Creedence. They're alligator men to me. John Fogerty, yeah. Come on. He's an alligator man.
The Creedence was great, but did they come from an actual swamp?
I don't know. Maybe. I've never looked into it.
If they don't have a swamp thing origin story, then I'm going to say it's a bit of an act, but it's a fun act. I always love Creedence when I was younger.
I still love Creedence. Wait, okay, but in the middle of this whole scene, we got to explain. So the hippies are dancing, the band is playing, all the rich people are horribly offended. And in the middle of the scene, hey, it's that same reptilian creep that scooped up Dracula's ashes 100 years ago. If anybody's an alligator man, it's him. He, you know, he's like got these creepy eyes. He's staring at everybody. And I don't know if he has like not aged since 100 years ago, or if this is supposed to be a descendant of that other guy. Either way, it's the exact same dude. It looks exactly the same, except he is now, I don't know, he's dressed sort of for the era. He's wearing a frilly pirate shirt, a burgundy velvet suit, and a black wide-brimmed fedora. So, cool.
I think he's supposed to be a descendant, because Dracula later says something to him about his bloodline.
That would make sense.
So, like, there's been a long line of Dracula enthusiasts, some of whom never got to meet Dracula, which would be kind of a bummer, right?
Yeah, yeah. They're just, you know, bridging the gap between generations.
Yeah.
Oh, and also we learned that his name is Johnny Alucard. Smooth.
Ah. We're not going to spoil. We're not going to spoil it yet. We're not going to tell you what Alucard means.
We're not going to tell you what it is spelled backwards. This is their kingdom.
Right.
Yeah, Johnny Nilbog here at the party. He's gazing out from under the brim of his fedora while everybody else has a good time. He doesn't look like he's having a good time. He's just sitting there watching with no expression. Of course, all of the fancy rich people are mortified. They're baffled about how all of these disgusting partygoers ended up in their flat. This old lady who's kind of a little bit Angela Lansbury-ish, she's like, what, you know, to her son, she's like, why did you invite all of these monsters? And he says, I didn't. They're not my friends. All I did was to invite the stone ground. But that just left me more confused. I'm like, why did he invite the stone ground? He invited this band?
Well, because stone ground is just a household name. Stone ground appeals to audiences of all ages, the old, the young, the hip, the square. Everyone loves stone ground. That's one of the film's early key messages.
I understand now, yes. Oh, but there's one thing in this party scene that I think does not make sense and did not work at all. It's the bit about timing how many minutes until the police arrive. So the guy who invited the stone ground goes and calls the police to get all the hippies out of his apartment. And then the hippies, the friends all start being like, oh, the fuzz will be here in 4 minutes. No, it'll be 6 minutes. It'll be 3.5 minutes. 8 minutes, and they're arguing with each other, and they explain that they have a running practice where I guess they party somewhere where they're unwanted until the minute before the police arrive, and then they leave. And it's not really funny, and it doesn't really make sense. It sort of lacks verisimilitude, but the bit just keeps going on.
It's a rather different relationship between hippies and law enforcement in this film versus certainly reality, but also I'm reminded of The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue, where, you know, it's firmly established that the man hates hippies, mm-hmm. that law enforcement just despises them. Whereas in this film, it's like, they're fun-loving. It's a fun-loving competition, you know? It's like, oh, you got me today, hippies. We'll get you tomorrow. Sort of thing.
And in the spirit of that sort of teasingness, like when the police arrived to bust up the party, they discover the hippies making out underneath the buffet table. And one of the hippies just says to the cop, peace, man. And the cop smiles. But also, there's a thing where when Johnny Alucard is about to leave the apartment, he takes the time to stop and torture the old lady about breaking her priceless antiques. Like he picks up this ceramic figurine and is tossing it hand to hand, and then just when she thinks, you know, he's setting it safely down on the table, he tips it over and it breaks on the floor. Ho ho.
He's a chaotic youth. He doesn't care about anything.
But so they split from the party. They go to their favorite coffee shop, except is it daytime now? I'm a little confused about the timeline. But they go to their favorite coffee shop, and the coffee shop is called Cavern, and this place is great. I wish I could go there.
Yeah, I kind of have to assume that what we see of the interiors is a set, but it's a great looking set. We got the like splashes of tile and all sorts of cool purple lighting. Like it just looks too cool to be a real space, but I could be wrong on that. And then they order up what at first I thought was like bowls of soup and Coca-Colas, but I think this is supposed to be coffee and or tea plus Coca-Colas.
I think there are Coca-Colas in glass bottles, but yes, the soup bowls are coffee cups, I think.
Okay.
They're just very wide and shallow for some reason. Oh, and I made a note that Cavern is right next to a store called Chelsea Mail, M-A-L-E. I don't know. Maybe that's clothing. I don't know. Anyway, at the coffee house, the hippies sit in a secluded booth, and Johnny Alucard talks about how everything's just boring. I'm sick of it all. It's all stale. We've got to find a new way to get our kicks. And he says, I want something new, yet as old as time. And he's got an idea. They all want to hear what his idea is. He leans forward and he says, a date with the devil, a bacchanal with Beelzebub. So they think he's joking around at first. Oh, you're just joshing Johnny Alucard. Ah, ha, ha. Ouija board, spirit mediums. That stuff's a bunch of funny nonsense. But Johnny Alucard is not joking. He's serious. He says, don't knock it unless you've tried it. And then Jessica, the most intelligent and level-headed of the group, comments, well, they do say it's dangerous. But at the other side of the table, Carolyn Monroe, as Laura, is here like, yes, yes, devil, take me to the devil now. So everybody eventually agrees, last of all, and reluctantly, Jessica, but they're all in. They're going to go to an abandoned London church later tonight at midnight to summon Satan. I don't know. I guess that's just how you have fun.
This may come later, but I did like the way they set up how various members of the Friends group are going along with this, where I think Jessica's boyfriend is like, this is, you know, it's like, yeah, Johnny's enthusiastic about it, but you know what's going to happen. We're going to show up. Somebody's going to get out a guitar. And we're going to have some food and some drinks. It's like, it's just going to be more or less like any other hang we do. It's just Johnny's going to read some weird stuff beforehand.
Yes, he said it'll just be beer, food, guitar, and loving in the end. Mm-hmm. Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May.
Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
But before we get to the summoning of Satan, we see a few little, there's some interludes. First of all, we see Johnny Alucard head home to his sweet flat, which his flat seems very cool. It's like well decorated. I don't know. It doesn't have that bachelor quality to it.
Yeah, yeah. I know what you mean. It feels like this is more space and it's in better shape than Johnny should have access to. He should have more of a, like a little hovel with Dracula posters on the walls. Turns out the good guys are the ones with Dracula posters on the walls.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So he goes to his house and he opens up a velvet box, and inside it's the ring. Yes. Dracula's ring. The one we saw the guy who looks exactly like Johnny take off of Dracula's corpse earlier on, and the vial of ashes. So he's got him. We also follow Jessica home, and this is where we learn that she is Jessica Van Helsing, and her grandfather, who she lives with, is Professor Lorimer Van Helsing, also played by Peter Cushing, again, a descendant of Larry from the prologue. And Grandfather Van Helsing is an expert on the occult. He has consulted with the police before to solve cases of ritual cult murder, and he comes into his office, catches his granddaughter reading his book, which is called The Treatise on Black Mass. He says, "Jessica, this is not a subject to mess around with. These are scientific works." But she mocks it. She says, you can buy that kind of book at any shop in Soho. Quote, "It's all kinky, you know." She says, "It's hobgoblins, black magic, etc." So she thinks it's all nonsense, has no interest whatsoever in the occult, and in fact seems to think it's not even superficially interesting. She like thinks that she can't bring her friends over to this place or to meet him because it would be interminably boring. But wait a minute, Jessica, don't you know that your friends are obsessed with summoning the devil? Like, they just expressed this extreme interest in the occult, and here she is like, my friends could never find out that you're an expert on the occult. It would be so embarrassing.
Yeah, Jessica is a bit of a brat, and I think intentionally so. Like, he has to politely move her feet off of his desk when he comes in and finds her reading the book of the occult. But at the same time, it's they do a great job letting us know that, yeah, he really cares about her and she really cares about him. But there is this, you know, some awkward generational stuff where, you know, the stuff grandpa's into is just lame. And yeah, she's kind of blind to the fact that there is this strong connection between what's about to happen in her friend group and the kind of stuff that grandpa actually knows quite a bit about.
Yeah, he patiently explains that, you know, our family has a legacy of research into the occult. And she's just like, it's not my bag, baby.
It's like the difference between a friend saying like, "Hey, I have this Doobie Brothers album," and then your grandpa saying, "Hey, I've got Doobie Brothers albums too." Like, it's not fair that grandpa is considered lame because he has this album and your friend has a pass because he just discovered it.
But that is how it works. Mm-hmm. No accounting for the social influences on taste formation. Mm-hmm. But also he's like, "Hey, what if I was to get to meet your friends? You know, I wonder who these people you hang out with all the time, who are they?" And she's like, you're never going to meet them because this place is boring and dusty and old, and you're an expert on the occult, so you will not meet them. But she tries to reassure him by saying she has never dropped acid, she is not shooting up, and she says she is not sleeping with anyone just yet, so he has no reason to worry. She is into nothing wrong. And then she goes to meet her friends at the deconsecrated church to raise the devil.
Yep.
So this black mass, what can we describe about the scene? First of all, there's a thing about the tombstone. On the outside, she and her boyfriend Bob are talking before they go into the church. They're waiting to meet everybody. And they stumble across the tombstone of her ancestor, Lawrence Van Helsing, who died 100 years ago to this day.
Yeah, which they initially think, oh, this is one of Johnny's jokes. This is not funny. They get a little disturbed over this.
It's one of Johnny's jokes. He had a fake tombstone made and put in this churchyard.
I don't know. You know, they're trying to figure it out. Other thing I would say is that this this abandoned church is just is a great set. Yeah. It's a great like gothic setting for what is inevitably going to be the resurrection of Count Dracula.
That's right. So Johnny Alucard is there. He's wearing an all black robe. He has everybody sit in a circle and listen to music. He says, "No fooling around. This is for real." And the tape he plays sounds kind of like the drum solo in Inagata De Vida, which is a thumbs up from me.
Yeah. It has this kind of like noisy, grimy quality to it, which I quite like. And again, you can hear this track is included on the soundtrack and score, along with those Stone Ground tracks, if you need to listen to those.
That must provide an odd contrast, but he's really telling them to get into it. He says, "Dig the music, kids. Let it flow into you. Give yourself up to the music." And this reminds me of Christian tracts that I have read, genuinely espousing the idea that rock music will allow a demon to possess your soul.
Yep.
Johnny Alucard seems to agree with that point of view. And then he starts naming demons. You know, he says, "I call upon Adras, the Grand Marquis of Hell." He says Marquis, provoker of discords, and upon Ronway, demon of forbidden knowledge, and upon Behemoth, the archdevil of black delights. I call upon Asmodeus, the destroyer, and Astaroth, friend of all the great lords of Hades. I demand an audience with his satanic majesty. He goes on and on. Names like 15 more demons, and ends with Count Dracula, which even in the context of the movie, for some reason, it just kind of sounds funny in this list of, biblical or at least like apocryphal or hermetic kind of entities.
Maybe. But at the same time, I don't know. We've talked already on the show, I think in listener mail episodes, about Marvel's Dracula and how in the Marvel Comics universe, Dracula will occasionally have interactions with the likes of Doctor Doom. You know, if Dracula can hang out with Dr. Doom on the moon, then I feel like it's equally okay that his name is mentioned in the same prayer as these various other dark and powerful demon lords.
So he says all these demons, but then he calls the name of Jessica Van Helsing. She's right here in the room with us. She's here listening to the music. She's digging the music as instructed. And he says that the demons have chosen her, but she is afraid. So she says, no, she's not going to join him up at the altar for whatever comes next. But somebody's ready. Somebody wants to go to the altar. And it's Laura, played by Carolyn Monroe. She's extremely jealous. She's like, no, me. And so it looks like it's going to be Laura instead for whatever this ritual will be. So she goes up, lies down on the altar, and Johnny Alucard cuts his hand, bleeds into a grail full of Dracula's ashes, and then pours them out on her. And it gets really thick and frothy. And this is disgusting. She's now covered in ashy blood. Everybody gets freaked out and runs away, except for Johnny and Laura. And of course, the ritual works. It resurrects Dracula from the earth where his ashes were buried 100 years before. And then Dracula is shot from below. So we're looking up at him like he is the Statue of Liberty, but a vampire. And he's surrounded by smoke and quite regal in his, as Johnny said, in his satanic majesty.
And I thought this was pretty effective. Like at this point, I'm really digging like, oh yeah, this is Dracula. This is the real deal. You've summoned him. And this is an incredibly dangerous situation for everybody involved.
But this is the part I mentioned earlier where he is right off the bat, extremely high-handed with Johnny. Johnny says, "Master, I did it. I summoned you." And Dracula just kind of scowls at him and says, "It was my will." And then holds out the ring for him to kiss.
Well, he's not going to suffer any, even if this is like, you know, a bloodline of toadies that are supposed to look after Dracula's interest and raise him from the grave. Like, he's not going to suffer a wizard trying to pull one over him here. He's going to establish right from the top that Dracula is the guy in charge.
Right. So he goes into the church. Laura's still hanging out there. He's like, I guess I'll drink her blood. And he does. And meanwhile, Johnny is looking on, biting his knuckle like, I wish that was me. And at first I thought he was thinking like, oh, I wish that was me drinking her blood. But then I realized, no, I think he's like, I wish that was me getting my blood drank.
Mm-hmm. Because that's what he ultimately wants. He wants the kiss of cursed immortality.
So the next day, Laura's body is found by kids playing in a construction area. They're sort of the kids from the Spirit of Dark and Lonely Waters commercial.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just sort of wild, unparented 70s children running around, finding dead bodies in the in the rubble. I mean, this is just how it went. I was born in the 70s as well.
Yeah, let's go climb on that rebar. The police show up. They open a murder investigation, and it is led by Inspector Murray. This is the detective we talked about earlier. Inspector Murray, in turn, consults with Laura Mervyn Helsing. I think they have a pre-existing relationship because Van Helsing knows all about weird occult murders. And the detective then reveals that the murder is connected to his granddaughter, Jessica, because Laura was part of her friend group.
They do acknowledge at one point, or Inspector Murray does, talking with somebody else. I think one of the other police investigators. He's like, well, you know, here in the UK, we don't really have cult murders like they do in America. You know, they're they're not as complicated as that and as heavy. We have some cult murders, but it's more British here.
So there is an investigation portion of the movie in the middle here. That had one scene that had Rachel and me rolling. It was the Alucard scene where, man, they don't skip over anything. They let you see the whole thing come together.
Spoil it for us, Joe. Tell everybody what Alucard means.
Well, so you see Peter Cushing there with a card, and he has written Dracula out on this piece of paper, and then he's drawing lines from the letters in Alucard to the letters in Dracula, and they all cross over, and he's like, it's Dracula spelled backwards.
The Dracula cipher, right? Or Alucard cipher, as if he just solved like a really complex puzzle here. When it's just so obvious on the page. But again, it just shows you how great Peter Cushing is. Such a stupid scene, but he sells it. He patiently brings dignity to the scene.
He doesn't just like write out Alucard and then look at it. He like draws all the lines. He does every letter.
You know, he's checking his work. And I guess we have to remember at this point, in Hammer canon anyway, nobody had solved the Dracula cipher yet. They didn't know what this meant. And so we had to watch him do it in real time.
That's true. It's like one of those math conjectures, you know, remains unproven.
Mm-hmm. But this is also good parenting/grandparenting tip that we're seeing here. Find out who your child or your grandchild's friends are. Write their names on a sheet of paper and just check and see if any of their first or last name happens to be Dracula spelled backwards.
I just knew I shouldn't have let my child play with Eoj Nifok.
Sorry, I don't have any paper out, Joe. I can't fact check that one to make sure that's okay.
Well, then you must be one of the idiots inferior. okay, so what happens next? So maybe I'm going to skip more lightly over some of the plot points that follow, but one sequence is Dracula, he really wants to eat Jessica Van Helsing. Actually, I think he wants to turn her into a vampire, right? To really just fully defile the name of Van Helsing. He wants to not just kill the end of the Van Helsing line, but make her a servant of the devil.
That's right. That's his evil plot for revenge here.
So the way they're going to make that happen is Johnny Alucard, does he invite Jessica Van Helsing to go to the jazz spectacular with him?
Yeah, he's like, hey, I got tickets to the jazz spectacular. Want to come? And she's like, no, thank you. I'm doing something else. And then Gaynor's like, hey, I'm looking to go to a concert.
What's he going to do? Well, he figures out I can at least feed Gaynor to Dracula.
Yeah, but this doesn't go over well with Dracula because Dracula, you know, rightfully so, is like, this is not what I charged you with. We have a specific plan for vengeance here. I will drink her blood and kill her, but you need to bring me the descendant of Van Helsing. And then, but Johnny Alucard is like, well, but you haven't given me any powers. And he basically does kind of like there's like a labor standoff.
Yes.
Here in the film. And Dracula caves. He's like, all right, I'll give you the powers.
So he bites him, turns Johnny Alucard into a vampire. And then Johnny Alucard, actually, before he gets on with the business of, of getting Jessica Van Helsing, he just goes out and gets a snack first, right? And he like finds a lady in a laundromat and eats her.
Yep. Just starts committing random vampire murders.
But at some point, Jessica's boyfriend, Bob, he comes to get her at her house. Now, she's been warned about things at this point by her grandfather, Van Helsing. But Bob comes and says, I think he says, your grandfather and the police are at the cavern. They're interviewing everybody and you need to come there now. Was that the story? I think it was.
I believe so, yes.
And in this scene, he strangely has a bandana tied around his neck.
Yep.
Did you see this one coming?
Yep.
So he does take her to the cavern, the coffee shop, but it's not the good guys. It's the bad guys.
That's right. It's a game of cat and mouse here between the Van Helsings and House Dracula.
So eventually Jessica is taken to the deconsecrated church. I think it's St. Bartholf's. And Dracula hypnotizes her, but doesn't vamp her yet. I think he's waiting for like the big midnight ritual or something. In the meantime, we get Van Helsing on the case. He's trying to find out how to rescue his granddaughter. And he ends up going to Johnny Alucard's house where they have a battle. It is Van Helsing versus a vampire, not Dracula yet, but the sort of young vamp. And I thought this was a good battle. I like this scene.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, this is the first vampire that this Van Helsing has ever battled.
Yeah.
And they do a good job, of making it a little unexpected. Like, for instance, earlier in the film, there's a little foreshadowing where they remind us that there's an often ignored bit of vampire lore that says that moving water, or moving fresh water, I think
clear
they say
running
in
water,
this film, yeah. Clear running water will, destabilize them or slay them or something. So I wonder if that'll come into play here.
Yes. I think he says that at the police station or something. Mm. He's listing all of the things that will harm or won't harm a vampire. Some of it's just superstition, but clear running water and a cross and a Bible, that'll do it. So there's a great move he has here where Johnny Alucard, like the sun is rising in the window and he's trapped. He's got to get back to his coffin so he can rest during the daylight. But then Peter Cushing throws a Bible into his coffin. He's like, oh, gotcha now.
Oh, yeah. Sleep on that. And this is like a full size one, too. It's not one of those little pocket ones that, you could just maybe like sleep around. But no, there's no sleeping in that coffin without laying on that Bible. It's ruined.
Right. That's a kathunk Bible. So they battle, but eventually Johnny Alucard falls into the shower. The water starts running and this destroys him. Like the water's running over him and he's screaming. He's like, turn it off, turn it off. And Van Helsing's like, where is Jessica? But he won't say. He's just getting obliterated by water.
Yeah. Is it the best vampire death in cinematic history? No. Is it at least inventive? Does it give us something a little bit new? Then yes, I think so.
Yeah, I kind of like this one. It seems actually like plausible from a folklore standpoint. That sounds like something that could really be believed to harm a vampire in some scenario. And I don't know. It was different. I liked it.
Yeah. I guess there is a bathtub scene in The Lost Boys or something, but that was like a bathtub full of holy water, I think.
Okay. I've forgotten about that.
If memory serves.
Also, Lost Boys came later.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Much later.
But eventually, Lorimer Van Helsing does go to the church to confront Dracula, and there is a great trap-setting scene. He digs a pit outside the church, and he fills it full of wooden stakes. He takes his trusty silver dagger with him, which he has showed off several times before, and there is a showdown, a final battle in the church. And there were a couple of parts here that I thought were actually kind of scary. I don't usually expect to find anything all that frightening in a Hammer horror movie, but like the part where Dracula is chasing Van Helsing up the spiral staircase into the tower, I thought was quite menacing.
Yeah, because really throughout the film, they do a great job of establishing Dracula as such a threat. And suddenly in that stairwell, it's like everything is so claustrophobic. And there's this feeling of just being in an enclosed space with something that is just beyond even a vicious animal, just pure bloodthirsty hunger.
Yeah. So they have a showdown. There's kind of a fake out here. Van Helsing stabs Dracula with his silver dagger, but Dracula is aided by the hypnotized Jessica Van Helsing. She comes up and pulls the dagger out of him, and her grandpa is like, "No, Jessica."
This one caught me up in the moment. You know the movie's not going to end like that. This movie's only ending one way, but getting caught up in just the sort of the spirit of the film, I was like, oh man, this is bad news.
But of course, we saw him dig that trap earlier, right?
And
so the trap comes back. In the end, he throws holy water. Van Helsing throws holy water on Dracula. That kind of burns him. Yow. And he falls into the pit. And then to really drive it home, Van Helsing like grabs a shovel and like shoves Dracula down onto the wooden stakes with the shovel. And this breaks the spell over Jessica. They're all right. And I guess some of her friends are still alive. Her boyfriend's dead. But I don't know, a few of the hippie group, they're still kicking around.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to hang out much anymore. But yeah, some survive. I will say, in this movie, you had two different scenes with the melting vampire. So you end up melting the same vampire twice in the same picture. They at least made sure to have the second vampire death look even better than the first. I have to say that this one looked really good and gnarly, and I liked it quite a bit.
Agree. So that's all I got for Dracula AD 1972. I enjoyed this one. I'm not gonna say it's the best Dracula movie I've ever seen, but if you're looking for those early 70s vibes and you want some Christopher Lee and Peter Cushing in there too, it's perfect.
Yeah, I'm not gonna recommend Dracula AD 1972 to everyone, but if the title Dracula AD 1972 stirs something inside you, then yes, you must see this film, and I encourage you to do so.
It's way better than Land of the Minotaur.
Yes, yes, I would agree. But the score for Land of the Minotaur was better, so I don't know.
Yeah. But Land of the Minotaur didn't have Stoneground.
That's right. If they'd only had the musical stylings of Stoneground. All right, we're going to go ahead and close this one out. But as always, we remind you that we're primarily a science podcast. Real science, not the Van Helsing branch of science, with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. But on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird movie here on Weird House Cinema. If you want a full list of the movies we've discussed over the years on Weird House Cinema, head on over to letterboxd.com. That's letterboxd.com. Our username there is Weird House, and we have a list, and you can see all the films we've talked about. You can go back through the archives there and see, well, what other Dracula movies have they watched? I guess kind of, sort of, two or three other Dracula films.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it! Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.